From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We have been here 12 hours today. 12 hours, and quite frankly, with one or two exceptions, what we've done today hasn't amounted to a pimple on a you-know-what. We've sat here and done diddly-squiddly-squat all day long, 12 hours. I've had three meals at this desk. I'm tired. And at 10:13 at night, you bring a major, major initiative. I think it's an outrage that we have to sit here after 12 hours and debate a major piece of legislation that could influence the agricultural heritage of this state for the next 50 years. Now let's go home. Let's go home and get some sleep. Come back in here tomorrow and we can talk hogs all day long. I think it's just absolutely stupid. It's no wonder that we make mistakes year after year. This is like a death march. I'm tired, I'm mad, I'm angry. I move we adjourn. That's not debatable. That calls for a vote. I move to adjourn the House.
That motion's not in order, Mr. Black.
That is not out of order.
Mr. Harkey.
True. Mr. Speaker, that is always in order. You don't give me that baloney. A motion to adjourn is in order. I called for a vote. I want my vote.
You were not recognized for that motion.
Don't you give me that baloney.
You were not recognized, Mr. Black.
I was recognized. You put that motion on the board. I made a motion to adjourn. It is always in order, and it is non-debatable. Now put it up there.
Mr. Black, we are one day away from a deadline on House bills.
Not my fault.
You have been here.
You can't run the House.
We have been here
for
years.
Mr. Speaker, I made a motion that is not debatable and is always in order. Put the motion on the board.
You are not recognized for that motion, Mr. Black.
Put the motion on the board.
Mr. Black, we have bills to do this evening.
You don't have anything to do. That's the problem.
We have bills to do.
We've been here 12 hours, and we haven't done anything.
We have been working on Republican and Democrat bills, Mr.
Black. My God, I'll tell you
what. The members on both sides of the aisle feel these bills are important.
You can do it without me. If you're going to ram this through and refuse a legitimate motion, by God, you'll do it without me. I'm going home.
That tirade on the Illinois House floor dates back to 1998 when the legislature was debating some regulation of large-scale hog farms. The orator there, famous during his tenure at the legislature, former State Representative Bill Black of Danville, whose role for the Republicans was debating the legislation, and that day he'd been on the floor a long time, sitting in the speaker's chair for that debate with the late Joel Brunswald. On this Christmas episode of State Week, we're going to sit around the Yule log and tell some legislative stories. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel on State Week includes Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at UIS. And he started covering the legislature to some degree for the Chicago Sun-Times back in 1970. Brian Mackey with us, reporter for WUIS, Illinois Public Radio. Sean Crawford, news director for WUIS. And with us, Amanda Venicky, State House Bureau Chief for the last few years at WUIS and Illinois Public Radio. Combined, well, I guess we have, dating back to Charlie's experience, in some form or another, legislative coverage of the past 45 years. So I guess we can give a half-century review. We promise not to do that with too much parliamentary procedure. By the way, I've got to ask you, Charlie Wheeler, is a motion to adjourn always in order?
I believe it is. But on the other hand, the guy who has the gavel is the one who determines what really counts.
And that's, as those of us who have covered the legislature, that's kind of what we're sitting around doing here on the holidays and eating some snacks and such. And person like Bill Black, a great orator, respected by both sides of the aisle. He was a Republican in leadership, but he came from a district that was a pro-union district. He was a pro-union lawmaker because back in that day they'd had a GM plant over around Danville that shut down. And he still kind of kept those loyalties and was kind of a man of downstate common sense as well, who was never always cared for suburban or Chicagoans in general. You might have liked them personally, but...
Well, and he also was a guy who had a great sense of humor. Now, the clip we listened to, he was genuinely mad. A lot of time, the individual in the minority who plays that role has to have a great talent for theatrics. He's got to get up and scream and shout and holler and carry on and act crazy. And that's kind of what's expected of the, what would you say, the minority scold on the floor. But Bill Black had a great sense of humor, too. I remember one time there was some kind of a parliamentary snafu going on, and the person in the chair, Frank Giglio, Representative Giglio, who was a plumbing contractor from Calumet City in the south suburbs, was getting himself snarled trying to figure out what the parliamentary procedure was going to be. And Black got up and did one of his tirades, but you could tell it was not with the same genuine emotion as we heard at the outset of the show. And he climaxed by saying, "Mr. Speaker, you're a man of honor. You're a licensed plumber," which kind of diffused the situation.
Well, Black was from, his family had a heating and cooling business, so I guess he would respect the plumber.
Sure.
In that situation. Now, one story, and Sean Crawford was there during some of Bill Black's time, and you were there, of course, Charlie, and is that Black did leave the floor that night, I'm pretty sure. A couple of times he was driving back home to Danville. He'd threatened to quit the legislature. One time Madigan even had to make the phone call to urge him to come on back. So he had a temper, and those tempers do get short. In that time of the legislature, it was not uncommon to see those 10 and 12-hour stretches. And Sean Crawford, you've seen a few of those kind of antics through the years, too.
Well, yeah, and I think you can go to the Illinois State Senate. Why I'm picking on Republicans here for these antics, I mean, we've talked about Mike Bost before. I remember Frank Watson when he was the Senate president. He would have these. Charlie, I know there are a lot of others who go way back on some of these people who would sort of like the limelight, and they, in some ways they crave that, I think, on the floor. But also, you know, we're legislators who understood the process, and in some ways it provided some levity, I think, you know, during those long days and those long debates that would take place.
Yeah, and it was certainly bipartisan. I remember former State Senator Ricky Hendon from
sure.
Chicago, who had his suits were as colorful as the draperies in the Senate sometimes, and he would get up there and say, particularly when the Democrats were relatively new to having power in the Illinois Senate again, which kind of coincided with when I started covering things down here just a decade ago, he would get up and, you know, the Republicans would be making complaints like we heard from Bill Black at the top of the show about, you know, you're ramming this bill through and we haven't had enough chance to debate it and think about it. And he would say, basically, how do you like it now? How do you like it? We had this for 10 years when you were in control. How do you like it? And, you know, go off on a rant. But I, to your point, I don't think we're picking on Republicans. I think that they've been sort of out of power, at least in the legislative sense, for so long that it, you know, it's a little less, how do I put this? It would be unseemly for the Democrats to gloat a little too much and have these kind of rants.
Well,
since
you have a lot more to yell about when you're not in power. Yeah.
Life is more unfair when you're in the minority
party. That's kind of the designated role. Someone in the minority party, when I started, it was a guy named Artie Telser, who was a pharmacist from Chicago. That was back in the day when we had multi-member districts and Republicans were elected regularly from Chicago. And I remember one time, and this was early on in my career, this would have been in the early 70s, and I thought people were actually going to come to blows on the House floor. And I ran into Telser afterwards, and I said, "Oh, man, you guys, you were really going at it." And he said, "Hey, what you got to understand is it's all showbiz."
And I think sometimes it's showbiz. Sometimes that's heartfelt. That,
speak
to these legislators,
in my day,
and it can be
more showbiz than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
I think
it's definitely a degree of both. There are some people that listen and I believe are almost turned off when they hear a legislator make a joke during serious debate. You know, I did a story regarding this repeated calling of a property tax hike that House Democrats are doing this year, which Republicans are saying they're stalling. And even in the midst of that, in Republican frustration and anger, they were able to joke back and forth. And I was playing the tape for some folks and they were like, wait, what? what's going on? They're not taking this seriously, and yet they're on the floor for so many hours, and there's a degree of, okay, we're going to fight about a bill, but we're going to get along otherwise. And then sometimes there really is a degree of, especially if you're in that minority party and you've got a bill that is stuck in the Rules Committee, which is basically it's never coming out, that it's frustrating as all get out.
And I think,
I think
you touched on it, Amanda. I think the Rules Committee, especially in the House, has been a big factor in that, in the fact that a lot of people feel they can't get heard because their legislation doesn't even make it to committee. And I think that's been a big change probably over the last many decades, is to see so many pieces of legislation that never even get, you know, a hearing at any point. So, yeah, I can see where people get frustrated with that.
Do we need to explain that the Rules Committee, basically all bills, when they get filed, immediately go to the Rules Committee? And that's basically the most loyal people to the Speaker and the Republican leader, or the minority leader for many years in the House, a Republican leader. And if they, you know, if the Speaker doesn't want the bill to advance, it's pretty much not going to get out of the Rules Committee.
There they
language. That's where they go to die.
And it wasn't always that way, Charlie, was it?
No, it wasn't. Back in my time, there were – well, the legislature was in continuous session in odd-numbered years and in even-numbered years. But in odd-numbered years, bills would be introduced, they'd be sent to the Rules Committee, and the Rules Committee would then forward them on to a substantive hearing committee. If it were a bill changing the criminal penalty, it would go to the Judiciary Committee. If it were a bill to raise revenue, it would go to the Revenue Committee, and so on. And it was automatic in the odd-numbered year. In the even-numbered year, because it was an election year and there was a desire to limit the workload, bills would only be moved to a substantive committee if they dealt with an emergency or if they dealt with the budget. And after watching this for a while, I concluded that an emergency was some piece of legislation that a majority member thought would be helpful to him or her in the re-election campaign.
And, of course, you can have shenanigans with the Rules Committee, too. Amanda, I think you'll remember a few years ago, I think there was an anti-abortion bill that would have required ultrasounds before a woman could have that medical procedure, and that was not sent to the Health Committee or the Executive Committee. I think it went to an Agriculture Committee, actually, because there were a lot of conservative Democrats on the Agriculture Committee and some people who wanted just to have at least the bill, you know, pass out of committee and be able to put that on a mailer, maybe engineered it so that it could be voted on.
In all these rules, I mean, it sounds obscure when at the beginning of every new session, the legislature will approve basically the rules of operation for the House and for the Senate. And it sounds, you know, arcane or just technical details and who cares. But it's all of that that really does give the majority party primarily their power. I mean, it's the written rules, not the unwritten rules, but the written rules that are the unwritten ways of power in the Illinois State Capitol in many instances.
Well, and that's something that I've seen, too, a change in from back when I started as a reporter. At one point, the Speaker of the House was William Redmond, who was a Democrat from DuPage County, from Bensenville. And he believed that every member was entitled to have his or her bill heard. And so as a result, bills would automatically move through committee, come to the floor, and Representative Black at the opening of the show alluded to being on the floor for 12 hours. Well, that was routine back in the day in the month of June in the Illinois House. And we go late into the evening debating literally hundreds of bills because Redmond thought everybody was entitled to their day in court. When he was succeeded by George Ryan as Speaker, things changed, and particularly then when Mike Madigan became Speaker, there was much more an attempt to limit the floor action, do more work in committee. The rules really changed, though, in the early 1990s when Republicans took control of the Senate and they amassed a great deal of power in the leadership by saying that floor amendments that are offered once as a bill has cleared committee and is ready to be considered on the floor, those amendments had to go to the Rules Committee to be considered whether or not they could be heard. When conference committee reports had to go to the Rules Committee, and those are legislative proposals that emerge from a joint Senate-House committee to reconcile differences between two versions of a bill, one passed by the House, one passed by the Senate. Those reports now have to go to the Rules Committee. And those give a lot more power, as we were talking about earlier, to the Speaker or the Senate President to control the flow of legislation. For example, when I started as a reporter, it was not uncommon to have literally hundreds of amendments filed to certain bills, and those amendments would all be heard. Now, there wouldn't be full debate on them all. Sometimes it would just be, here's amendment number 43, Representative Wheeler, and somebody would move to table the amendment. But they all got some kind of at least perfunctory treatment. There was not a gatekeeping committee that would keep a member from offering an amendment to be considered on the floor, as is the case today with the Rules Committee in the House and the Assignment Committee in the Senate.
You mentioned the Senate President, and probably one of the more interesting Senate Presidents we had through the years, during my time, Sean Crawford, was James Pate Phillip. And what a lot of us liked about Pate Phillip is he was candidly honest on certain topics, and he did so in a way it would be different than Donald Trump's blunt statements, but sometimes they echoed the same.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Trump. I think in some ways, even as a reporter, you do like somebody who gives you a good soundbite. You like somebody that will comment on something and not just say, oh, I haven't read the legislation. You know, you like somebody who's going to tell you their thoughts, their gut feelings about something.
Yeah, that cuts through and speaks real.
He was a character. There's no doubt about that. He angered a lot of people, I think, especially in the Democratic Party and people maybe more on the left, of course, with certain positions he took. Sometimes I think his positions he took were not that well thought out. I don't think he paid a lot of attention to the issue in some cases. At the same time, the difference that I saw with him, very conservative fellow from DuPage County, compared to, I think, some of the attitude you're seeing today, is that he still felt as though government had to keep going. Government had to move ahead. He would work with Mike Madigan. They were pretty much polar opposites. I think Charlie would agree with that. He did, of course, when he was in power, have Republican governors to work with. But still, he didn't always get along with them either. He was more conservative than the Republican governors. So he would still, though, be able to come to the table and get things done. So I think in some ways, when you look back at him, a very interesting fellow, as I said, a character, I think, and there's many of those on both sides, but certainly he stands out from a leadership perspective. I mean, maybe as colorful as anybody that's been in leadership in a long time.
When I think of Pate Phillip, and then I think of Governor Rauner campaigning on the fact that Mike Madigan has run the state for 40 years or whatever the mantra is, you know, the tax hike Mike ploy that the Republicans are using. I'm thinking, were I still a reporter, I would be very tempted to call Pate Phillip and say, did you think you were a puppet of Mike Madigan back in the day? Now, the response would be something that you could not really use, not even on public radio, much less
response,
in a family newspaper.
Sure.
And I think it would be negative. As a matter of fact, you talk about Pate not getting along with Republican governors. Back in 97, when Jim Edgar had a plan to increase the income tax, roll back property taxes, put more money into poor school districts, the bill got out of the House. Mike Madigan pushed it through the House, which had a Democratic majority. There were maybe half a dozen Republicans who voted for it. And it went to the Senate, and it died there. It was sent to committee, and it never got out of committee because Pate Phillip didn't like it. Now, this is his governor of his party, but Pate thought that it would result in people in his district up in the northeast corner of DuPage County having to pay more income taxes and not getting anything back from this plan for their schools.
And it is a measure that everybody thought if it makes it to the Senate floor today, it's going to pass.
Oh, yeah, the votes were there.
And he confidently and unapologetically killed that piece of legislation in what a lot of people really thought it was the closest that there had been at that time and still to this date.
And since.
One of the things Republicans had going for them then, I think Brian and Amanda can allude to this some more, is that back then Republicans and conservatism really had control of the suburbs. And today, that's not necessarily the case. You have a lot of people who I would call certainly more moderate, and even on the Democratic ticket, who are now representing areas that for years had been represented by Republicans. So it's not quite as simple as it was for Pate Phillip, I think, some of the decisions and some of the issues that were made then to be a leader today.
Yeah, although I would say that suburban conservatism is still shaping the debate down here, and that's why we haven't had a tax increase, right? Because Democrats do have supermajorities, but they've gotten those supermajorities through gerrymandering and recruiting candidates in the suburbs who feel that they cannot vote for a tax increase because it would be too politically damaging to them, or because, let's give them the benefit of the doubt for it's the spirit of the season, that, you know, they have a deep-seated belief that they should not raise taxes. But yeah, that is still. Yeah, exactly.
Well,
and
the fact of the matter is, when inevitably we do raise taxes, they won't have to vote for it because it will be what's called a structured roll call. Each party will decide how many people they're going to put on, how many green lights they're going to light up. And in essence, the leader will say, Wheeler, you're going to vote yes. Crawford, you can vote no. Mackey, you have to vote yes. And that's the way it'll be. And as a result, and this might seem counterintuitive, if you go back and look at the roll calls of all the tax increases from the time in 69 when we enacted an income tax, and look at the people who voted yes and see how they fared the next time they were up for re-election, and compare that to the people who voted no, you'd find that the people who voted yes got re-elected at a higher percentage rate than the people who voted no. And that might seem, as they say, counterintuitive, but it's because those were structured roll calls. People who voted yes were in safe districts where it would take almost an act of God to have somebody from the other party win that seat. And the people who were marginal got to vote no, but because they were marginal, the next time they were up, a certain number of them got ousted.
You know, Which is where, with an eye toward the current budget situation, and of course there is an attempt to change how Illinois draws those legislative districts, with the hope being that there will be more competitive districts because there are so few of those districts where there is a legitimate contest at any point in time, if anybody even runs in the primary or the general, either way in that regard, that the question being, okay, it's going to perhaps be even tougher to get a tax hike. Charlie, you say it's inevitable, but that with more competitive districts, there will be fewer of those people in those safe seats to vote the yes in a structured roll call.
Well, but we're going to have that structured roll call vote long before we're going to change how we do redistricting.
Oh, yeah. But with the Rauner money, I think there's a whole lot of thought that this will be even more difficult in the current climate because we're in a different place. As you talked to Sean,
that Rauner money is going to be used to protect lawmakers who vote how he wants.
Right.
And the whole premise of the structured roll call is that the governor is going to be on board. This isn't going to be something the legislative leaders put together on their own without the governor. It's going to be the governor and the Democratic leaders and the Republican leaders agreeing, here's the plan of action that we're going to go forward.
Let's all imagine that.
Well, one thing, all these names and all this, you know, history that you're going through here, too, when I think back on it, the one constant in the time that I've really been following the legislature has been Mike Madigan. And how many times have we heard, you know, he's in trouble, or, you know, somebody got the better of him. Oh, Rod Blagojevich is going to get the better of him, or maybe, you know, it's going to be Pate Phillip or something like that. Madigan has endured, like him or whether you don't like him, it doesn't really matter. He's been there. Now, he wears some of the collar when things go wrong because he's been in power for so long. At the same time, I wouldn't count him out going forward either.
Now, one thing you mentioned, Pate, on that same topic, I like that Pate seemed to get that kind of criticism, too. And it just seemed like he just didn't care thoroughly.
I don't know that Madigan cares a lot about that either. I mean, I think he still has a long-term view of things. I mean, I don't know that he worries if the Chicago Tribune writes a bad headline about Mike Madigan. Maybe he does. Maybe I don't know that. But it hasn't seemed like he has run his operation that way through the years.
Well, just to the extent that correct me if I'm wrong on this, but to the extent that it affects his majority or his ability to retain power is when he starts to care. So he went through a long stretch. When I started down here, it was considered extraordinary for anyone to get even a two-word quote from the speaker for a story, because there was this period of a number of years where he just was not talking to reporters. He'd make, you know, a speech here maybe, and he'd do a TV interview there, but rarely talking to reporters. This year, we can't stop seeing the guy. He's doing so many news conferences. He's basically exhausting the press corps. You know, people asking this end up asking the same questions over and over.
I think his silence reflected his feeling that when his daughter, Lisa Madigan, first ran for attorney general, that she had been mistreated by the press. And as a reporter, I didn't think that was the case at all. I thought she was treated fairly. But as someone who has two daughters of my own, I know exactly where Mike Madigan was coming from.
Sure. But so as now that he, you know, now that he has been made an issue in the campaign anew, and perhaps to a level, you know, in a TV advertising blitz from the governor over the summer, you know, that is somewhat new for him, maybe he feels it's advantageous to be much more seemingly open with the press.
The difference to him and Pate Phillip is he will say only what he wants to say. Pate Phillip, I still sometimes think he would start to answer a question and not know where he was going with it. Again, you know, it was colorful and it was refreshing in some cases to hear somebody talk off the cuff and from the gut of what's going on in their mind. But Mike Madigan is much more calculated.
Even on a subject like they were going to make some rules regarding referees.
There was a time where it was a bill that was going to – we had an intern, actually, one of Charlie's interns who was covering a bill that would have increased penalties if you harmed a sports referee. And he was asked about it. His response was something like, well, some people tell me that once in a while they need to be popped, you know, because sometimes they're so bad at their job or something like that, make so many bad calls. And I remember the intern coming back and she played this for us and I was like, well, we got to go with that. And next thing you know, Sports Illustrated picked up us and the quote appeared in a Sports Illustrated the next week because of it. But again, I don't know that he cared on that. I don't know that that bothered him. He lost no sleep, I'm sure, over that. And like I said, I'm not trying to play him off as being somebody that didn't care about the process. I really think he did. And I think he was overall probably representing his constituents and his caucus.
Charlie, I want you to tell a story, and we've only got a couple of minutes left here in our Christmas gathering.
Yeah, which one?
But you ended up with soup on you, and you had a couple of personalities involved in that.
Yeah, well, to set the scene for this, this was back, I believe, in 1977, and there was a fight over who was going to be Senate president. Democrats had a majority, but they were split. The Mayor Daley Democrats, the machine Democrats, if you will, were backing Tom Hines for president. There was a group of anti-Daley, independent progressives, and they were backing Terry Bruce, who was a senator from Olney down in southeastern Illinois. And this went on ultimately to, I think, 185, 186 ballots, something like that. But midway through the process, a senator from western Illinois named John Linebaugh Neupel started to vote. He was thoroughly frustrated. He was with the machine Democrats, and he was very frustrated with these independents who were called the Crazy Eight at the time. And so he started voting for people like Winnie the Pooh, Alice in Wonderland. And at one point in a break in the proceedings, I was on the Senate floor talking to two of the Crazy Eight. Don Clark Netsch from Chicago, Ken Busby from Carbondale. And John Neupel comes along, and he's got a styrofoam cup of vegetable soup, and he pretends to trip, and he throws the soup on the three of us. And I didn't know what to do. George Sangmeister, who was a Democratic senator from Okina, and I'm from Joliet, so he was like my hometown senator, he says to me, "Why didn't you pop the SOB?" And I said, "George, he's got a pacemaker. If I pop him, he'll croak." George, who was a former state's attorney in Will County, says, "I'll defend you."
And on that note, we've got to wrap up our Christmas show. Thanks to Sean Crawford for joining us. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org. Production assistance for today's program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.